and welcome to The Clock and Talk. I'm your host, Tez. We are an Arsenal podcast, but today we're talking all World Cup with a little bit of Arsenal. Each and every week, I'm joined by a couple of my good mates. Tony, how are you, mate?
Mates? I could barely stand you, mate. I'm all good, thanks. I'm enjoying this festival of football. Some games haven't been the best, but anything that allows me to sit on my sofa for pretty much 10 hours straight and watch football work for me.
It's a marathon of football. It's fucking game after game. It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it is literally, like, as I said, even when the games are bad, it's just like, well, the alternative would be watching some other shit like that I don't care about. So, like, even I prefer to watch a bad game over a good episode of, I don't know, fucking EastEnders or some shit that I don't watch. So, for me, yeah, just this festival of football really works for me.
I thought there was going to be a mention of Love Island there, but...
No, because that I would prefer to watch a good Love Island over a terrible football match, and so I didn't want to bring
one
it up.
1 minute, 1 minute into the show, and you're already talking about Love Island.
Yeah, it didn't fit the point I was making, so I wasn't going to bring it up. But as Tez got me on the subject, what a program!
okay, moving right along. Our little mate from he's currently in America, and it's the world of soccer down there, isn't it, mate? How are you?
Oh, it's so bad, boys. You have no idea what I'm going through. I shared a couple of links with Tez and Tony for our listeners, and I'm sure some people who listen to us in America will know exactly what I'm talking about. The World Cup here is a sham because the commentary is so bad that pretty much everyone watching is watching on Telemundo and watching the games in Spanish. Because we have all these weird references coming up during the English feed. So it's pretty sad, actually, but, you know, football is pretty good when it's muted as well. So I guess that's the go for the next couple of months, or month, rather.
Since you brought up shambles, I have to make a mention for our Australian listeners. As they'd all know, Optus is our broadcaster over here, and what a fucking shambles it is. You only have to follow Optus at Optus Sport. Basically, the CEO has come out today and apologised to the... Australian football fans, because Optus just hasn't held up. I don't know whether it's the infrastructure or the app. Basically, it's driven through the app on a internet service, a little bit like BN Sports. But Optus just can't keep up with the amount of people watching it. So good luck on Optus, and good luck for the future there, because I don't know. But unfortunately, I think that's the way football and these sporting events are going to go, is a streaming-based service. And Optus are really learning the hard way at the moment. So, Tony, look, we're not going to go through every single game because there's been some cracking games, but I'm going to start with a bit of a theme, like a good, the bad, and the ugly. So, Tony, out of the games that you've seen, mate, what's your good moment out of the nine games? Well, this is the ninth game now as we're recording Costa Rica and Serbia.
I don't want to pick an individual moment. I just want to pick all of the Spain-Portugal game. I can't remember the last time I've seen a game of football that good. Like, just the whole game. And it wasn't just... Sometimes you get high-scoring games and they're exciting and they're entertaining, but the quality isn't all there. And you get goals because the quality isn't there and the defenders are bad and whatnot. And I know, obviously, Ronaldo's second came from a De Gea mistake, but the quality of the whole game was so high. Spain were unbelievable with the ball, moving it so quick, not really losing it. Portugal looked devastating on the counter-attack. They were so fast going forward. Just the quality of the whole game, I thought, was unbelievable. So I don't want to pick one moment from that game, although if I did, it'd be Ronaldo's free kick. But I don't want to pick one moment. Just that whole game for me was just... If you don't enjoy that, football isn't for you.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, if you don't like football, watch that game, because it was brilliant. It was a real showpiece of what football is about. Schwinn, what's your good, mate?
I do want to talk about that Ronaldo free kick, because, wow, ice cold, you know? Right when the penalty was awarded, there was, of course, David De Gea trying to play some mind games with Cristiano, but I'm sure he's not going to try and do that ever again. And the way Ronaldo eventually took focus at the end, and you know, the referee bumped into him, that's never good. When you'll be thrown off a little bit. but the steel to go through it, the nerves, the calm mentality to just to whip through the ball and leave David De Gea stranded. Fantastic, fantastic game, and hard to disagree with you boys there. For me, the good would be Peru. I think that game was a surprise, the Peru-Denmark game.
Yep.
Peru were also very comfortable on the ball. Of course, nowhere close to Spain, but you found themselves, you know, getting into situations where you would think, well, they're not going to be able to wriggle out of here. And they did very comfortably, not through luck, but actually through technique. Cueva stood out a bit. Of course, he missed the penalty, but I thought he had a pretty good game otherwise. And even players like Advíncula and Carrillo. So I really enjoyed that game, and that was one that I was not expecting to enjoy. So that's always a positive.
Yeah, it was a. I honestly don't know how they didn't score. And a lot of people, we talk about the Argentina and Iceland for a minute. Messi, they say he missed, but hey, was a good goalkeeper, or did he miss the penalty? But you look at the Peru penalty, and how did he miss that?
Just skied it. I think he tried to put a little too much sauce on it. He was probably nervy. I think you can tell by the stutter. And, you know, the more elaborate a run-up is usually to the ball, I feel that's directly proportional to how nervous you are. Look at Griezmann's penalty, and I'm sure we'll talk about the Australia game at some point. But he took one step before he hit the ball into the side netting, and that's a perfect penalty. So you don't really need to run from outside the box, you know, unless you're just going to run and try to deceive the goalkeeper without taking a stutter. I mean, it is the stage, it's the World Cup, so you're as high as it, you know, as it can get when it comes to pressure. So it's understandable, but to answer in the way they did in terms of the way they played, especially Cueva after missing the penalty, I think they deserve a lot of credit. And it's unfortunate that they didn't win, but at the end of the day, I think they'll have a lot to be positive about and move on from here.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting group, that, with Australia in it. And like I say, we'll get to that a bit later. But before we get that, my good was a team called Russia, because I actually wrote these teams off when we done our preview. I said, you know, would Russia be the World Cup if they were hosting the event? And I thought, Saudi Arabia aren't the greatest of teams. You know, it might be a 1-0 victory. Could even go a 1-1 draw. But to come out in the opening game and get 5-0, I thought was amazing opening game. I know there's been lots of other games and great games, but you're under the spotlight of the world, and you know, when you're hosting an event of this scale, to come out and get 5-0 result, I thought that was really good for Russia. Tony, what's your bad, mate?
I'm going to go with the Nigeria performance against Croatia yesterday, just because I expected so much more from them. I wasn't surprised that they lost. I think when we done our how we thought the group would go, I said Croatia would come second, and to come second, they would have to beat Nigeria. But Nigeria were just so flat. You expect them to have pace and power and really have a go, and they just didn't. I don't think, I'm not 100%, but I don't think they had a shot on target. I'm sure I read that somewhere. It was just, they just didn't turn up. There was nothing. There was no pace. There was no intensity. There was no pressing. It was just like, and I don't think Croatia was good. Were good, which is what makes it more for me bad. I mean, look, Nigeria were better than Saudi Arabia were against Russia. So I'm not saying it's the worst performance of the team, but of the tournament. Sorry, but from what I expected, and what they were up against, it was just, they just done nothing. And I'm assuming all Nigerians are disappointed with that. I've seen, obviously, we're Arsenal based, and a lot of our followers are Arsenal based, and who we follow as well. And I've seen some people sort of having a go at Iwobi or laughing at Iwobi, but I mean, there was 11 of them plus subs. I don't know how many subs come on, two or three, and none of them done anything. So was Iwobi good? No. Was he any worse than anyone else? For me, no. I just thought the whole performance was abject at best.
Mm-hmm. That would surprise me a lot. Like, I know the 2-0 result, it was an own goal. There was a penalty in that game too, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was an own goal and a penalty.
Own goal and a penalty. So Croatia weren't the greatest. But yeah, Nigeria, Yeah, I agree with you. Nigeria did fell short of the benchmark for me. Schwinn, what's your bad, mate?
Argentina. I mean, Iceland did very well. I don't want to take anything away from them, blah, 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 right? But at the end of the day, when you're watching Argentina and you just see the teams on paper, and I know football is not supposed to be played on paper, but the amount of options they have, the amount of, you know, big stars, big talents they have. First of all, the starting 11 was sort of questionable. You don't expect some of the players to get in ahead of the others. And the subs also sort of didn't scream optimism and clear tactical plan, which is not something you say a lot of São Paulo usually. But I think the team is too Messi-centric. I think that's the mistake. You know, you want to produce an environment that's conducive to Messi and helps Messi elevate himself. And rather than doing that, it just seems like everything is going through Messi. You have the likes of Di Maria, Paulo Dybala on the bench, Higuain, Aguero. I mean, the options are there. And it just feels like, you know, you go up one of the wings, try to bring the ball back a little bit, and then Messi drops back into midfield, tries to play a give and go and make something off of it. And when a team is sitting so deep like Iceland were, it's going to be difficult to find open lanes. And that's exactly what happened. They produce some good chances, but you expect, you know, Argentina to be threatening throughout, which they weren't. And of course, when the moment came to capitalize, Messi uncharacteristically fluffed a penalty, which of course has been the case, I think, with the last six or seven last penalties he's taken. But you just knew even before he took the penalty, I had the sense of that he's not going to be able to score this. And of course, if he did, then we'd be like, of course, it's Messi and he's going to score. But the whole performance screamed of, you know, very pedestrian mentality, and that was available to watch from the football that was being played too.
Before I get to my bad, I'm just going to touch on Messi because I think it was Tony. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tony. You said Messi's trying too hard.
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, that's basically what I noticed exactly the same. Messi just seemed to be trying too hard. I don't know how Argentina are going to go now. Di Maria,
just quickly, Tez, was he trying too hard, or do you think he has been told to try too hard?
I think what I'm trying to get at
with that question? I'm just not sure whether that's the game plan or whether that's just Argentina players giving him the ball because he's Messi.
Well, that's the thing. For me, he's playing like he doesn't trust anyone else, so he has to do everything himself. And the problem with that as well is the other players are playing like that. They have the ball and there can be four options on, one being Messi. And even if he's the worst option, they give the ball to him. So he's playing like he's coming and picking the balls up off the centre backs because it's like he doesn't trust the players to get the ball to him. And granted, they're not as good as the players he has at Barcelona getting the ball through to him, but they're still good players. So he's doing that. But then when other players get the ball, like the amount of times Di Maria got not in behind, but down the wing and tried to cut it back to Messi every single time. And even in the end, the Iceland players were sort of embarrassed by it. They were just going to stand next to Messi and forgetting everyone else. It was literally just like you knew at all times the ball was going to Messi, regardless of whether he was a good option or not. So the reason I said he was trying too hard was the amount of times he was running and coming and literally taking it off the centre-back's feet. They weren't even passing it to him. He was essentially tackling his own centre-backs. 1-0. Oh, he's missed a sitter. Mitrovic has just missed a 1-on-1. Sorry. I was saying he was trying too hard because he was doing too much. But then the other players were playing like, oh, we can't do this. Only Messi can sort this out.
Hmm.
I thought it was really poor.
Yeah, and I was going to say exactly similar to what you were saying about Di Maria. He just kept cutting it back into Messi. And Messi, oh, I don't know whether he's told to do it, Schwinn, or that was their game plan, get the ball to Messi, Messi will score. But he just, I don't know whether it's the weight of a nation. And, everybody almost says Messi, you know, if he's not the best in the world, he's obviously up there with Ronaldo as the best in the world, and you can debate yourselves on that one. But, you know, is it, if Messi retired, you know, next year, do you think his career would be darkened by not winning a World Cup?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, look, football is very quantitative, but it's also very qualitative, and people will remember how he went crashing out. You know, if it's one thing not to perform and lose the game, and it's one thing to give it a go and be unlucky on the day. I don't think any of us would argue that it was the latter yesterday for Argentina. It was definitely the former. They were poor. That's it. And this is not just a reflection on Messi. I think we should also talk about Sampaoli if things keep going this way at the end of the group stages, because Argentina have not really had a tactical coach, at least for the last two World Cups, I would argue. And this is the first time they've had. And you expect someone of Sampaoli's vigor and, you know, mentality to switch things around. He's kicking every ball in the touchline. And you would imagine for him to register these things, as you guys just pointed out to. But there wasn't a recognition of this. And it seems like Messi is once again, you know, looming large on the team. When you have him right, the right manager, he'll control the likes of Messi and he'll control the tempo that the team set. And they're just unable to do that. That's very disappointing. I want Argentina to do well. I'm not an Argentina fan, but I want Messi to do well because, you know, he probably would cement his position as the best player in the world. But right now, in today's world, there is no argument that Ronaldo is not in just in better form, but I think Ronaldo's aged better. Someone made an analogy the other day that he's very much like LeBron James in that regard, that he's also managed to make teammates around him better as he's grown with age. And that's a fantastic thing to do as you grow older in football and sort of diminish physically. Not that I'm saying Ronaldo is diminishing physically, but at this given moment in time, I definitely take Ronaldo in my team over Messi. And I don't think I've ever said that before in my life.
Interesting. Look, my bad, and you guys have sort of stole a bit of the thunder with Nigeria and Argentina, so I'm going to have to go back to the World Cup pre-show. Robbie Williams, what the fuck is going on with that lad? Old grey-haired get up there singing some shit about nothing. Surely they could have got someone better.
Tony seemed to enjoy it.
Fuck it.
He was pretty pissed that I missed it.
Oh, and then what did he do, the big fuck you at the end of it or something? What was all that about?
I have literally no idea. It is a weird one because he's not been relevant for a long time. Like, and it's the opening ceremony of the World Cup. You've got to think everyone's available.
Yeah.
I mean, the budget was probably pretty big as well. So you're thinking, pick any musician. And I'd imagine pretty much everyone was available. So to go for someone that's not been relevant for 10 years and I don't get it at all.
Me and you both, mate.
We've not had a World Cup song this year either, right? Because we've usually had Shakira or Kinnan or one of those chaps, a Pitbull.
No, yeah, they got Pitbull, that one with Will Smith, isn't it?
Oh, did they really? I think I missed it. I think it just flown below the radar. Was it not good enough?
It's been floating around. Yeah, it was.
I don't think it was, to be honest.
You haven't
heard
it?
Yeah, me neither, because usually those World Cup songs are pretty iconic, and, you know, they catch on and...
Live It Up, it was called.
Oh, that's the one, okay. I'll have to check that out,
this
because...
Yeah. You haven't heard it?
No, it doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the one. Live It Up by Nicky Jam, like Will Smith's in it, and... Yeah.
Interesting.
Have a listen.
That completely flew below the radar for me.
But yeah, better than Robbie Williams. what was your ugly, Tony?
I know neither of you two would have caught this, but the commentary on France, Australia, we had Mark Lawrenson, and I have no particular feelings towards Pavard, the French centre back that he played at right back. Yeah. I don't care about him. I'm not pro or negative him. But how negative Mark Lawrenson was about him was ridiculous. He literally like was huffing and puffing every time he got the ball, like, Pavard again, this is gonna break down. Every time he played the ball backwards, he was like, this guy's useless. He just passes it backwards. Like, how was he in this team? And you're thinking, he's a right back. Like, he's not their number 10. And then at one time, the ball was over the other side of the pitch, nothing to do with Pavard. And he went, just out of the blue, they're talking about something else, and he went, you can't tell me there's not a better French right-back than this Pavard bloke. And I'm thinking, just give it a rest. Like,
oh,
I don't
Jesus
need you.
Christ.
Like, I think people get caught up. I don't know if I watch football differently to other people, but I don't want to know the commentator's opinions. I can form my own opinion. I'm perfectly good at that. So if I think he's playing bad, like I tweeted it out and someone said, well, he's not having a good game, but the other 10 are as bad. This was in the first half. And I was like, yeah, I know. So I've formed an opinion. You formed an opinion. Someone has just scored a ridiculous free kick. Kolarov. Outrageous goal. Sorry. Yeah, so I'm thinking, like, I don't want your opinion. Don't tell me if a player's, especially when he's never heard of them before. He's watching them for the first time. He doesn't know how they perform week in, week out for their team. So, like, it was just ridiculous. And everyone on Twitter was just hammering him. And so I'm hoping he doesn't get another game. It was literally painful to listen to.
Wasn't we linked to that guy?
Yes.
Yeah, that was the guy we'll link to. Okay.
So what? Yeah, I'm not defending him because we've been linked with him. I don't think he was brilliant, but it was so over the top. It was literally outrageous.
Yeah. Twin, what was your ugly, mate?
I'll have to bring in the commentary here as well, and I'll leave you guys with a snippet of how one of the games was started here, and the commentator, right as the ball was kicked off, said, "It's soccer time." So imagine how you get put off by that at the beginning of a football game.
That wasn't the worst. Sorry, I know I'm stealing your thunder here, but that wasn't the worst bit of commentary I've heard from America.
Was it Iceland beats Argentina 1-1? Was that worse?
Yes. I mean, that just defies, like, that's not even knowing anything about football. That's simple maths. Like, the most basic of maths.
Oh, yeah. It's been so bad, guys. I'm telling you. I don't know how I'm laughing about it. Maybe because I'm speaking with you guys after a while, so I'm happy about that. But, Jesus Christ, it's been horrible.
That was a cracker free kick, wasn't it?
Oh, that's outrageous.
Yeah.
Automatic.
That was unreal. Fuck, I think I got a draw on this game, too. I went. Okay, my ugly... What was my ugly... Oh, I have to mention it, boys, and I apologise. But it'll probably segue into this game. France versus Australia. It went to a penalty, VAR. Now, the VAR decided to obviously go back on what the original call was with the referee and awarded a penalty. So that was my ugly, pretty quick one, but... My next question will be to Tony and Schwinn. Was it a penalty, Blatz? Tony?
I tweeted before they even went to VAR, before I knew they was going to VAR, I tweeted, I thought it was a penalty before I'd seen it again. If I was a ref, as soon as it happened, I would have given a penalty. And seeing it back, it probably wasn't as much of a penalty as I thought it was initially, but I still think it was a penalty.
Okay. Schwinn?
I didn't watch the game live, so I don't know how it felt in the flesh as it was happening. But having seen the replay, I think the defender, whoever was chasing Griezmann, tries to get a touch on the ball. He misses. And I think he, in a very cheeky way, sort of tries to impede Griezmann. And, you know, when you're making that contact in the box, I want to say it's a soft penalty. But as I said, if you're trying to make that contact in the box, then you got to make sure you get the ball. And if you don't, then that chance will always be that the referee calls it against you. And that's exactly what happened. So, I mean, I feel for the Aussies. But I will just quickly make a point that I think the refereeing this tournament has been very good. From the games I watched, which have been most of them, except a couple maybe here and there. In spurts, but I managed to watch a lot of football, and the refereeing has been very, very good.
Yeah, so I might be a little bit biased, and I probably am. Originally, I thought penalty, but then looking it back, and there was an angle that came out today. I don't know if I shared it with you boys, but there was a different angle that the referee didn't get to have a look at. And if you actually look at that camera view, he just got a toe on the ball. So
yeah, so for me, for me, he definitely got a touch on the ball, and we saw that angle straight away. But
yep.
I think gone are the days, like in the 70s, in the 1970s, if you got the ball, it didn't matter what you'd done afterwards. You could kick someone in the face. As long as you got the ball with the other foot, it was sort of deemed fine.
Mm.
But for me, he got a touch on the ball, but Griezmann still had that ball under control. He got the touch in, he was still one-on-one, and then he makes contact after, which is what brings Griezmann down. So he does get the ball, but for me, that's sort of irrelevant. because he's taken him out after that. That's what there's been a lot of debate about that decision here. And the majority of people think it's a penalty, but the stupid commentator that I was going on about that was kept going on about Pavard, all he kept saying is, but he's got the ball, but he's got the ball. But as I said, I think that's irrelevant because Griezmann took that perfect touch still and was still in on goal. It's not like you can touch the ball and then a second later take him out just because you've touched the ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's... Yeah, okay.
There's been a debate here about it, and he did touch the ball.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see where people are getting confused. But if you look after that, after he touches the ball, Griezmann still takes his perfect touch and is still one-on-one and then gets brought down.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't think you can... In him touching the ball comes into consideration.
Yeah. Okay. Look, and like I said, I may be a little bit biased because obviously Australia, but I still think we come out all right. We played all right, and we actually tactically really surprised me in defence. So, which I did tweet out a couple of times. We don't mind having a hack as well. So a lot of Aussies over here were saying that the ref was very biased towards us. But every other day of the week and every other game, we were having a bit of a hack. A couple of them tackles. I even said to one of the boys, might have been Glenn or one of the lads, I said, geez, we're going to see a red card here very soon if we don't settle it down a little bit. So, but 2-1 against France. So that was, that was my ugly... Probably because it was a game where I felt that, we could almost draw this game, so that's why it was pretty ugly.
Well, yeah, you was hard done by. I tweeted that as soon as I'm not sure if it's been changed to an own goal yet. It surely will be. But as soon as that went in, you could see that took the wind out of the Aussie sails, so to speak. But
yeah,
I tweeted straight away, like, it's very cruel on Australia. I think you were very hard done by.
Mm-hmm.
You matched them. It seems like maybe you didn't match them for quality, but not many people will. But in terms of the battle and the football match as a whole, you perfectly matched them. And I think you were a bit hard done by.
Oh, thanks, mate. Denmark and Peru, though. I'm worried about Peru out of both of them. They look really good, Peru. Okay, boys. So that's about... any girls you want to add on what you've seen, Tony, around the World Cup?
No, not off the top of my head. I've just seen that Kolarov free kick again, and I know everyone would have seen it by the time this goes out, but it's literally ridiculous.
Okay, well, let's move on to a little bit of Arsenal news, and I have to talk about my legend golden boy, Granit Xhaka. Tony, he signed a new contract. How good's that, mate?
Yeah, look, I rate Xhaka. A lot of people thought that the potential or seemingly done signing of Lucas Torreira could damage Xhaka. I think he's a perfect type of Emery player, to be honest. I like him. I think he has so much potential. I've said on here many times, I think he has all of the aspects we need from him. He just never shows them, or very rarely shows them all at the same time. So one game his passing's excellent, or his long passing's excellent and he can't defend, or his positioning's poor. The next week he'll be excellent defensively, great positioning, but can't pass the ball 2 yards. Towards the end of the season, we saw it all coming together a bit more, and he was good in a lot of games. So to me, it seemed logical. I don't know. I'd imagine he signed a 5-year contract when he signed 2 years ago, so he's getting down to 3 years. And hopefully, more than anything, it shows a change in our model that we're going to start tying these people down earlier rather than leaving it into the last 2 or 1 year, and then you start worrying.
So I was going to ask you, so because I didn't see, is it what? So he's there for another 5 years?
I don't know what the extension is. They just, Arsenal are annoying because they just say long term.
Yeah. Okay. So you didn't hear either, righto. Schwinn, what do you think, mate?
Great minds think alike, don't they? And we've spoken time and again about Granit's importance to us. And it's nice to know that the boss now also has made his confidence in Granit public by agreeing this deal. And I'm sure he probably didn't negotiate the terms of the deal, but I'm sure he was involved in the process to some extent or the other. But it's good to see that we're tying up players much before than we need to. We've often ran contracts down, and as we do that, you know, the ball is switching over to the player's court. Aaron Ramsey is an example from now. And of course, we all remember what happened with Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez. But, you know, but to a wider point, I think it's all about Granit at the moment because he's irreplaceable. For anyone who watched the Egypt-Uruguay game, you know, Elneny does a job, but as soon as you have to ask him to play a ball forward, it just seems like he loses his confidence and he's very nervy on those balls. And we really don't have someone who can turn in for Granit when the going gets tough and we have 3-4 games coming up. So I think it's a very positive move. I think it gives a lot of confidence to someone like Granit that he has a place at the club, even under the new manager. And someone like Torreira, as Tony just mentioned, will be, in my opinion, a very good complement to him. So I'm very excited. It's just all I'm thinking about right now is Aaron Ramsey. I just want a decision on him. Just go or sign an extension. And I don't want any more confusion there. It's driving me nuts at this point. Haven't heard any reports. No reports of a link to a different club. You know, it's just so slow that I want to think something, but then I have nothing to go off of. And it's a little nervy for me.
Yeah, it is for me too, mate. I'd like to know what's going on there, and I think Arsenal and every Arsenal fan would like to know what's going on there. But Granit is an excellent bit of news just before the World Cup. People did say that it all happened over in the World Cup in Russia. So, and a couple of people actually said, not whether you believe the reports or not. I don't know if you've seen it, Tony, that they were tweeting that if Arsenal officials are over in Russia doing Granit's deal, they must be scouting some more players.
Well, I mean, it was scouts will be, every club will have, well, every major club will have scouts there anyway. The Xhaka deal has been done while he's been away with Switzerland, but that could have been any time in the last 2 weeks. They said, I think Arsenal said in their actual press release, it was done on Wednesday. Yep. Which obviously the day before the tournament started. But yeah, I mean, it would have been agreed. It's not like they've gone out and everything would have been agreed and they've just gone out to do the final touches. So, I mean, I don't know who would have gone over to do that, because if it's literally just a signing of a document, you don't need anyone important. You just
probably
need someone
to go and sign
the document. Yeah, just take this piece of paper to Russia, please, mate. Yeah, I mean, we'll have scouts there anyway. It was widely reported that we had scouts at the Spain game. But I'd imagine that we have scouts at least one of the games every day.
I'd imagine so. So I probably shouldn't have used the term scouts, because the certain person that I was referring to, actually, I think he said Kazidis and Sven was there. So I thought...
Well, Sven is essentially a scout. I know his job title is head of recruitment or something along those lines, but he's a scout.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he'd be over there having a look at the talent, looking for the next Yamas Rodriguez or something.
Well, it's not only that, and it's as well, like, sometimes he may have seen a player play in, say, Pavard, for example. He's seen him play in a mid-ish table team in Germany, and he wants to see how he does it at a higher level. And the World Cup is... Well, you can argue if it's a higher level or not, but you want to see how he does it on the big stage. So sometimes as well, it's just it's a bit of confirmation to see how a player adapts in different surroundings. How many times before have we seen players that are excellent at one club go somewhere else and it just doesn't work for them? And it's just because they were comfortable in that surrounding. And showing them international football, again, you can argue about the difference in level, if it's better, if it's worse. There's an argument to be had. But what's certain is it's different. It's a different situation, different scenario. So you're seeing players in they may not be out of their comfort zone, but they're in a different comfort zone. And you can sometimes learn a lot about a player by seeing that. Obviously, because I'm watching Costa Rica and he's on my screen now, Joel Campbell looks excellent every time he plays for Costa Rica. And he's comfortable in that zone. When he's played for us, for me, I know some people argue, for me, he's never excited me. I don't think he's ever really look good bar in the odd couple of moments, and maybe that comfort zone or that level of quality just doesn't suit him. So I think scouts will not only look for players that they don't know already, because I think it's very dangerous to sign a player based on a good World Cup, but they'll look to learn more about players that they already know a bit about.
Funny enough, you must have read my mind, because I was just going to ask you, Now, what are you thinking of Joel Campbell in this game? We're at the 70th minute, Serbia and Costa Rica, and he has been having a good game. Okay, I want to touch on Jack Wilshere, Tony.
Yeah, it looks like he's off. So Arsenal released their release list. So they know everyone notifies the FA of who is no longer going to be remaining at the club. It's usually full of youth players and people that are retiring and whatnot. So Mertesacker and Cazorla would have been on the release list, and then a load of youth players and whatnot. But Jack was actually down as retained, so we're keeping him at Arsenal. From what I've heard, it didn't come down to financials at all. I think he'd pretty much agreed on the money and everything, but he wanted to speak to Emery to see where he fitted in his plans. Again, from what I've heard, that was that Jack's not going to be a first team player or a starter. And I would agree with that. And that's just not what he wanted at this time. He feels like he's been told he missed out on the World Cup due to not playing enough football. For me, that's nonsense because he's played more than a lot of the players that are in the squad. But he's been given the reason you're not playing for England because you've not played enough. And then to go to your club and your club say, well, you're not going to be playing, you're not a starter, I think that's pretty much turned his head and it looks like he's going to be going elsewhere. I don't know where that is, but it looks like he's off.
Where don't you want him to go?
I don't really care.
Don't bother you.
Look, I like Jack, but once you're not an Arsenal player, look, I'll always like him. He's always going to be an Arsenal boy, and there's always players that you look out for when they've gone elsewhere to see how they do. There's been players that have left Arsenal in the past, and you sort of always keep half an eye on them, but I don't think he's going to end up at a team that's going to hurt us because he does want to play a lot. So he's
Crystal Palace or Fulham or something like that.
I think Palace are probably the front runners. Interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, so Palace are going on tour. Their pre-season tour's in Poland. And the Palace Poland Supporters Club came out, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and said, one of our members works in the hotel that Palace are staying at. And I know I'm reaching a bit here. And they've booked the room for Jack Wilshere. I don't know how true that is, but that was the rumour going around.
Really?
So it would be interesting if he ended. Yeah. Again, look, there's no way of proving it whether someone's just, you know what I mean? They thought, oh, we're coming to Poland. It's like when Arsenal went to America, Schwing could have easily said, oh, yeah, I work in the hotel. We've booked the room for Mbappe. We don't know if he works. Well, we do. But you know what I mean? You don't know if he works in the hotel or not. You ain't got a clue.
That's right.
And in all honesty, I doubt they book rooms in names. Because it's not like when me and you go on holiday, we're only booking it for us. So you tell the hotel we're staying in that room. But they'll book 30 rooms as a club. So I doubt they put names on every one of them rooms. But I don't know.
Well, it'd be interesting to see. Crystal Palace, geez, they could use him too.
Well, Hodgson likes him as well, which is probably a lot of where the thought started that he would end up there, is because Hodgson's a manager and it's known that Hodgson likes Jack.
Schwinn, got any dad on Jack, mate? You going to miss him if he does go?
I will. I mean, he's been one of those faces around the club who've been there for a long time, and you know, every now and then when the club is not doing well, you look around for people to give you some comfort, and Theo was very, very good at that, despite not performing. You know, he was a presence around the club that was very calm, and of course he's been very professional in that regard. That in front of the camera, he's very well trained. Jack was another player like that, and not having him around is going to be sad, and seeing him in a different club, in a way a rival club, is going to be even worse. But you know what? He was given this season to prove a point, and I think he just fell short of the mark. I think if he had gone for the World Cup, that would have been a plus in his column. And I think his performances were not good, but not bad on an average, of course. I think he could have done a little more to prove his case. a couple of better games, a couple of moments where his fortunes could have turned. And unfortunately, other than that Chelsea goal, which was, of course, a cracking finish, we don't remember too many of those moments from the season. I mean, as Tony was speaking about Jack, I was thinking about, you know, these certain instances, and there's a couple that come to mind, but other than that Chelsea goal, nothing of result. So it's not going to be easy, but I think long term is the right thing to do. And you know, maybe 6 months down the line, when we've reaped the fruits of some of our hard work under Emery, we might not look back at this with distaste and be happy to part ways when the time was right.
Yeah, I was just thinking then as you were talking, geez, I could probably only think of maybe a couple of Europa League games that he stood out in. He didn't really have the greatest of seasons, but he wasn't a player that we all went at the end of the season, geez, he had a shit year. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like I think a couple of us said Iwobi and Mustafi. Jack didn't stick out for me as a really, really bad player, but didn't stand out as probably the highlight of our season either and a great player. So it's a bit of a middle of the road for me. Look, obviously he will be missed and you're dead right. You know, when you look at the Walcotts, Ramsey's, even Oxlade-Chamberlain, and then you see if Jack goes, it's type of that old Arsenal, isn't it? The old members or the old players around the club are moving on to greener pastures. I totally understand, though. What is he, 26 years of age? So, you know, this may be his last contract, maybe. If he signs a four-year deal, it'll take him up to 30, so... You know, he's only getting older. So I do understand first team football. I would imagine a 4-year deal would type of seem Tony up to 30 or something, you know.
I'd imagine a 4-year deal. Just going back on what you were saying, I think in football we have quite short memories. And I would agree that he had an average season overall, but that's because he was, I thought he was exceptional when he first came back into the team. And he was pretty much getting, on our polls especially, he was getting man of the match every game he played when he first came back into the team. But then he was very bad towards the end of the season. So I think it was average, but not because he didn't excel at times, but because it was dragged down by being bad at the end of the season.
You're probably right.
I mean, actually, I know it may be difficult to think of moments, but if he was the best player, like say West Ham away, it was a shit game, it was 0-0. It was awful, but he was our best player by an absolute mile. So you go, he didn't have a moment. But if he's better than any of our other players on the pitch, in a way, that's a credit. Similarly, neither of you mentioned the Chelsea goal, but for me, his best performance was Palace away. He was exceptional. And again, another one. I think there was about 5-6 games in a row, because they were both in December, both the games I just mentioned. There was about 5-6 games in a row where everyone said, he was our man in a match. If not the man in a match, he was our man in a match. And so I think he did have them periods, but then towards the end of the season, he let himself down a bit. So I'd agree it was an average season, but maybe not for the same reasons as you guys said.
I will remind you, though, Tony, and you should know me and Schwinn by now, we've got memories like a goldfish. So
that's an insult to a goldfish.
Look, this next subject, fixtures. I've got it here on the run. It doesn't mean a lot for me, Tony, but obviously for you as a fan travelling to the games. The only thing I suppose is the first two I look at and go, holy shit, I hope we've got our shit on by then. Start of the season is at Chelsea and City, but
other than that, the other way around,
City, Chelsea. Yeah, okay. So they're the only two that I think, well, okay, that's a cracking start to the season. But as a fan travelling to the games, mate, what was your thoughts on the fixtures?
I mean, I didn't really look at it as a travelling fan's perspective, but I'm really unsure on whether it's a good time to play City or not. Look, they're going to have a lot of players go deep into the World Cup, you'd imagine, which means they'll come back late, which means they'll hopefully miss that game. If we're realistic, we'll probably only have Ozil that goes deep in the World Cup. Potentially Nacho, but he won't have played too much. So it may be a very good time to play them. It may not. Similar with Chelsea, they're going to have players that go deep. If you look at someone like Kante, who's probably, and Hazard, who are definitely their two best players, they're both got a good chance of going deep in the World Cup, which means they might not be back, or they might be back to full fitness by the time we play them. They've also got huge manager issues at Chelsea. Well, we don't know what's going on. So it may be a good time to play them. I'm not sure. On paper, it's as bad a start as you can get, pretty much. But it may be a plus. I don't know. Mm. In terms of travelling, our first three games are all in London. So we're obviously home for two of them, and then the other one, which is Chelsea away, is obviously in London as well. We do then follow that by going to Cardiff and Cardiff away, and then Newcastle away are, I think, our next two games after them three. So then we start racking up the miles. But, yeah, it's not... As I said, I can see the fear over the fixtures, but I can also see the positives, and I'm not sure which side I'm leaning at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you whether I know win or not.
Schwinn, what's your thoughts on the fixtures, mate?
I mean, I was trying to think about it as Tony was speaking, how I feel about it one way or the other, but you know, football moves so fast that even 2 days is a long time in football, and as Tony was detailing the different issues or the advantages we could potentially face, you know, things might change. France may bow out. You know, there's possibilities of things happening that will change how one feels about the opposition. And, you know, Chelsea could fix up their manager situation in the next week or two. And, you know, that's one thing taken out of the negative column for them. So, I mean, it's very difficult to say. What I'm looking at are the games after Chelsea. And, you know, we have West Ham, Cardiff, Newcastle, Everton, Watford, Fulham, Leicester, Crystal Palace. And then we have our next big game, which is Liverpool. So the stretch between Chelsea and Liverpool, I think, will be important, because if you're able to get 3 points out of six after our first two games, right, I think that's a decent start considering the opposition. And then till we play Liverpool, I think we can really focus on building momentum. That's a lot of games in there. So I think that will be a crucial crucial patch for us. And if we're able to perform well against Liverpool, I think that will give us a lot of momentum going into the Tottenham game, which is, I think, 2 weeks or 3 weeks after we play Liverpool at the Emirates. So in all probability, I think we have a very good lineup of fixtures. I think the first two games will probably be a reality check in one way or the other. And that's not a bad way to start the season, I feel. I think Emery will also be given a little more leeway. You know, fans will probably be a little more sensitive and not rail into him if we don't do well against City, and if indeed we do draw points against Chelsea. So I think it's a positive in a way. And that I'll be looking at that patch closely to determine how the rest of the season might go.
Just one thing I forgot to say, sorry. Premier League go fuck themselves giving us Man United away on a Wednesday. It's a joke. Like, just have local games for midweek. It's not that hard. Anywhere within 50 miles. For us, that's about 8 teams. Most clubs would have 3 or 4 options. To make a club, and look, other clubs may have it worse. I don't know. I've not looked. But to make a team travel 170, 180 miles on a Wednesday night, not the club, obviously it doesn't matter to the players, I'm talking about for the fans. The average working man isn't going to be able to go.
Hmm.
Which, that should never be a problem. I think it's ridiculous. There's so many ways around it, but the Premier League don't care. It gives them a good midweek fixture to put on TV. But I just think it's a joke. And it's not the type of game that should be played midweek anyway. You never get as big a build-up with a midweek game because everyone's at work and going about their normal life. So, like, Arsenal-Man United shouldn't be a midweek game anyway. But they don't care, do they?
Did I see, though, and it was only on the comment after you tweeted that out, that can change?
So all fixtures are subject to change, but...
what's the likelihood of it, though?
Almost definitely not going to move, because we've got Tottenham on the weekend before...
Yep. That's Sunday, December the... Well, Sunday for me, sorry. So it'll be Saturday,
Well, no, at the moment, all fixtures are penciled in for Saturday 3 o'clock, and obviously most of them will change. But so we've got Tottenham the week before, then we've got Man United midweek, then we've got a league game on the weekend, and then the weekend after, we've got a... Or the weekend before, on the week before, sorry, we've got Europa League. So it's very, very unlikely that, it will get moved. There is always a midweek fixture that week penciled in. This year, I know I just mentioned it, but it was West Ham away this year. Again, 10 miles away, if that. So it's not too bad. But there is almost certainly not going to be moved.
Okay. There you go. Yeah, it's a bit of a fucking bit of a shit for you, isn't it? Well, even for just everyday
work.
It
doesn't matter for me personally, but it does matter for a lot of people. And I know, especially from the countries that you two guys are in, saying a 200-mile journey, you lot probably think, oh, yeah, I'll do that while I'm asleep, obviously with the size of your countries. But for us, obviously, if you finish work at 5 in London and with London traffic, there's no way you're getting to Old Trafford for a 7:45 kickoff or even an 8 o'clock kickoff. So... although, as I said, 200 miles might not sound like a huge distance to you, it just makes it impossible for people that, or they have to take half days from work
to get to the game. It is silly. I was just going to ask very quickly, because we're running out of time, we've got to talk to a couple of our listeners. Champions Cup, so we've got Atletico Madrid, who else? We've got PSG and then Chelsea. Obviously, everyone, all us Arsenal fans, are going to be really having a look at these games because, you know, it's the first time we're going to actually see Emery, and what happens, you know, how is he set up, and all the questions are going to be answered, I suppose. Does he take this as a bit of a test run, though? And what if he, you know, we're looking three games in, these three games, and we haven't won a game, you know, the question's starting to be asked, we're going to have a shit season, you know, all the negativity shit. What's your take on that?
For me, just he uses it as a chance to see how the players work within his system. Even if it's the same formation on paper as we've used before, which I don't think it will be, but even if it is, he's going to obviously... He said he wants the high press, and the theory of high pressing and actually doing it and fitting in the system, you can high press all day on the training ground, but it's going to be completely different in a game. And in pre-season, when the fitness isn't all there anyway... it's just going to have a chance to him to get used to the players and the players to get used to him in actual match situations. I've never looked too much into results in pre-season. Yep. Beat by Munich last year and got absolutely battered by Chelsea. It's always on who's more ready. That's all that really matters in pre-season. And so if you lose 3-0, it doesn't mean you're particularly worse than the team you've lost 3-0 to. It just means they're more ready. Or... they've picked a stronger team because the manager's going to want to see his whole squad. So when we lost to Chelsea, we had, I think, Reece Nelson started. I don't even want to say half a team from us. It was less than half a team from us. Well, from them, it was not full strength, but not far off. And so it looks on paper, Arsenal lost 3-0 to Chelsea, but you can't really look too much into it. So I think pre-season friendlies are just on who's more ready and... who has picked the stronger team for that particular game.
Okay, because I don't want to break it to you, boys, but that's only 39 days away. Atletico Madrid. So, yeah, it's going to be... Anyway. Righto, let's...
Just to point out and blow my own trumpet, remember when I said on the podcast we'd be playing Chelsea in Ireland and you looked at the fixtures and said no? I was right.
Yeah, righto. Schwinn, take this man. Get him away of me. Okay, so we are up to our favourite part of the show where we actually speak to a couple of our listeners, and you can do that each week. We're going to run with this, so you can get us on Skype. Just follow us on Twitter at @clockend_talk. We'll share the link a few times on Skype. You can add us to the group chat, and when we record our podcast, basically you can come on and ask us a question. This week we've got Vish. How are you, mate?
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good, mate. Good. It's good to hear your voice, mate.
Yeah. Probably I sound better than how I speak on Twitter.
That's all right. You've been following us a long time, mate, and we know who you are, so we got an eye on you, buddy. what's your question, mate?
What do you think of the chances of the likes of Joel Campbell Ainsley Maitland-Niles and Alexi will be improving under our new manager.
Tony?
Personally, I don't really think Joel Campbell will be given a chance to. I think even if he does improve, I think he's so far away from the required level that even if he makes a 10% improvement, which is a huge amount, I still don't think he would be good enough for a place at Arsenal. So I think they'll just cut their losses on him, whether they can get a fee for him because he's still got a year left, or even if they let him go on a free just to get him off the wage bill. So I don't think he's going to come into it. In terms of Ainsley, he's going to get a lot more chances, and a lot of learning is about experience. You make less mistakes when you have the experience because you know how game situations are. So, especially with Ainsley's age as well, I would expect to see a big improvement in him over maybe the next 2 years. I think this season he's a Europa League centre midfielder and maybe our fourth or fifth choice, but I personally think we're going to play a flat three, so being fourth or fifth choice isn't the end of the world. And then if he needs to impress in them situations, and towards the end of the season he may be in the starting lineup or really pushing for next season. That I think that'll be the plan for Ainsley. In terms of Iwobi, everyone knows I don't rate him. There is something in there. I don't think he'll ever be enough to be an Arsenal player, but there is parts of his game that are quite nice. I personally would loan him out to a team where he's going to play 30-plus games and tell him to go and prove himself. I don't think he's ever going to improve by, even if he has the best coaching in the world, if he's not going to get on the pitch, which I don't think he should do at Arsenal at the moment, you're never really going to improve. You can't improve too much on the training ground because you're never putting these things into match situation, and it's easy to do things when you're not under pressure. Just as a bit of a side note, obviously I don't do it anymore, but I used to get to every game an hour early and watch the warm-up. And the amount of times I used to see Philip Senderos put free kicks in the top corner from 30 yards in the warm-up, it was like every week he'd do five. There's no pressure. All of these players can do it. I mean, there was a video going around of Koscielny doing like a Rabona into the top corner. You think he could ever do that in a game? Of course not. So with Iwobi, it doesn't matter how much they improve him on the training field. Unless he can put these things into games, then it doesn't matter. And he's not going to get the games at Arsenal. So for me, I would loan him out to somewhere where he is going to play a lot and say, look, this is your addition. Go prove yourself. Go and win your Arsenal shirt. That would be my plan going forward for them. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, just talking about Joel Campbell, Tony, and Vish wouldn't have heard this part of the podcast just yet because of the editing and whatnot, but we're just talking about how we just watched him for Costa Rica, and we were both all saying that, you know, he's having a really, really good game. Do you think Emery would be looking at, you know, these World Cups or Sven or whoever's, you know, choosing what happens to a few of those players and go, we need a right winger. He's been playing at a good World Cup. Give him a shot. And we lost Tony.
Oh, you're asking me. We're asking Vic.
Sorry, mate.
No, look, as I said before, I always think it's a bad idea to sign players on a World Cup performance alone. And it'd be even worse to start playing a player for your club. Like they've seen him for 4 years now, and he's not lived up to the grade expected of an Arsenal player. So just because he came on as a sub for the last half hour of a game just now and looked quite bright. I mean, he didn't do anything. He just looked like if anything was to happen, it would come through him. But he didn't actually do anything. So for me, I don't think the World Cup should... Look, if he has a James Rodriguez-type tournament, breaks out, scores 7 goals and is up for the player of the tournament, then you've got to start rethinking things.
Mm.
Or it just means you're going to get a bigger fee for him. But for me, I think they know he's not at the level. And just if he has a mediocre to good World Cup... doesn't mean he is now at that level. And it goes back to what I'm saying about comfort zones and being what you're used to. International football is usually at a slower pace. It's usually less physical. Some players are comfortable with that. And when you up the pace and up the physicality, they can't handle it. And other players are maybe worse when they've got a bit of time and space, but they're really good when they're under pressure and everything's fast-paced and physical. There's a lot of England players that... You look at him in international football, I think, Jesus Christ, this guy can't play football. because they're actually got time and they actually have to show their football ability. Whereas in the Premier League, they look half decent because they're very good under pressure and they're very strong and they've got a really good engine. So they look good in that situation. So I don't think the World Cup compares to league football. And I've always said it's a bad idea to sign someone just based on a good international tournament.
Good World Cup. What do you think?
I think if you're looking at a young gem, then it might be different because you can pick them up for next to nothing and take the chance on them, which is what we done on Joel Campbell 4 years ago, pretty much. But when you're looking at a top end or a higher end player, then I think it's a terrible idea.
Okay. Vish, what do you think of that, man?
Yeah, I completely agree. Looking at him play, other than perhaps converting him into wing-back, how Victor Moses was converted into wing-back when they realised he's not very good as an attacking forward, I don't see a future for versus Joel Campbell at Arsenal. Also, what does Tony think of the fact that Jack Wilshere might be off or is off to Palace soon?
We've just done a bit on this that you'll hear later, but just to quickly sum up, I still don't know if it will be Palace. Obviously, they look like they're the front runners. I think it's a good move for him. From what I know, the financials wasn't an issue. It was the amount of playing time he was going to get. He feels like he's just missed out on the World Cup. He's been told he's missed out on the World Cup due to not playing enough. And then he's been told by Arsenal that you're not an automatic starter. And I think he feels he's just at a time in his life where he needs to be playing football. So I think it's a good move for him. I agree that he shouldn't be. I would like him to stay at Arsenal. I think he's different from anyone else we've got, which would have changed which means you can change the game in a different way. But I also agree he's not an automatic starter. So if his decision is that if I'm not an automatic starter, I'm going to go somewhere else, then fair play to him. And I fully understand that decision. I would like him to be at Arsenal as an impact player, but he feels that that's not what he wants to be. And in a way, you kind of can't criticise that. We criticised Walcott for years for being happy just to sit on the bench and earn his money. And now I think Jack's probably going to get criticised for doing the opposite. So I think sometimes you can't win, but I think it's a good move for him to go somewhere where he's going to play if that's what he's looking for.
Okay. Schwinn, I'd never have asked you about Joel Campbell, mate. What's your thoughts on Joel Campbell?
He can go fuck right off.
You're a nice, miserable cunt, aren't you?
I'm just done with these halfway players, though, mate. I mean, under Arsene, all these players got enough of an opportunity to make amends again and again and again. And you know what they ended up doing? They ended up going into the comfort zone that Tony's been speaking about all this while. We need to reinstate ourselves. We need to be a little more ruthless. You know, we will give to the players as much as they give to us. We might cut corners for a Mesut Ozil, which, you know, I obviously don't condone all the time. But we cannot keep doing that anymore. You know, how many years has it been since we've been loaning out Joel Campbell? I'm just done with this crap. I don't care if he has a fantastic World Cup. I don't care if he has a James Rodriguez World Cup. Sell him. We'll get 20 million for him at best, right? I mean, let's be honest. Who's going to come in for a Joel Campbell who scores four or five goals? An Everton, a West Ham, a Hoffenheim. They're not going to pay more than 20, 25, 30 million. 30 million is an ask anyway, because everyone knows that he's on the periphery of our squad. So it's not as if, you know, they know that we're going to start him next week in the Premier League. But we just can't rely on these players anymore. And, you know, as Vish asked, it's not just about these three young players who are going to improve in terms of coaching. I'm more excited to see what happens with Hector Bellerin. I'm more excited to see what happens with Mustafi. Mesut Ozil, how is he going to respond to Emery's, you know, different rigorous workouts and, of course, the demand on the pitch? I'm done with all these players who are just sitting around, you know, getting a good wage because they're half on the books of Arsenal and taking the club for a ride. I'm done with this stuff.
And that is Schwinn, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. And I don't know where the old Schwinn, the fence sitter, has gone, but, mate, I'm liking this new Schwinn.
He just fell off
the fence and fucking, whoa! I'm lost for words,
mate.
I'm speechless.
Lineups are out and Mesut Ozil starts, so I'm a happy man today.
I'm not even going to ask about Lucas Perez.
Well, you know what? There's a different answer on that because when Vish did ask this question, I was going to say Lucas Perez seems someone who Emery seems to favor. And I'd rather have Lucas in our team. I think whatever we saw of him, whatever little we saw of him, wasn't bad. He scored a hat trick for us in a you know, decent Champions League game. I thought he connected very well with the likes of Mesut Ozil, Aaron Ramsey to an extent. I think his interplay was pretty good. I'm not sure why Arsenal never favored him. Maybe that signing was forced down his throat. But I was never dissatisfied with what I watched of Lucas. And I think under Emery, we have that as an option for right wing as well. So I don't think Joel Campbell will figure anywhere.
Okay, Vish, any response to that, mate? Or you agree with Schwinn?
No, I 100% agree with him there. We really need to trim the sword and get rid of all the dead wood, and starting with Joel Campbell. But if Schwinn was saying we're going to get 20 million from Joel Campbell, we were struggling to get 17, to recoup the 17 for Lucas Perez. So we'd be lucky to get 5 for Joel Campbell at this rate.
Well, I just to clarify, Vish, I meant that if he has a James Rodriguez World Cup, right? If he ends up scoring 5 to 7 goals, as Tony said, then that's the max we can expect. And that, again, is, you know, looking at the ceiling of where things might turn up. And that's obviously driven by which club comes in for him. And it's obviously not going to be a top club from any of the top 5 leagues in Europe. So 20 million would be the icing, if anything. I don't think we can expect more than 5, as you said, otherwise, for sure.
Okay. Look, Vish, you might as well hang on with us, mate, because we're going to run through a couple of questions that other people have asked on the Skype, on the bloody Twitter, and you can ask them questions at @clockend_talk. But as I'm reading through, Vish, we've got straight one from you, mate. After watching that brilliant display from Spain versus Portugal, Tony, would you swap Ozil for Isco or wait for Xhaka or Thiago? Runs and hides before Tez explodes.
Look, I think you're looking at very different players, although they may play in similar positions. They may occupy similar positions on the pitch, but their roles are two separate scales. This is weird because I've never answered the question to the person that asked it. For me, look, Isco is a beautiful footballer. I think you watch it and just think this guy is just so smooth. He never loses the ball. His feet are insane. I would argue the productivity isn't really there. And I'm sure someone will probably come out with stats that he had a better season than Ozil at some point in terms of productivity. But I think the thing with Ozil is you may not always enjoy him. He may not be that silky, smooth footballer with the style that Isco has. But he produces either directly end product by goals and assists, or a lot of what Schwinn calls hockey assists or pre-assists. I think Ozil was very effective in the final third, whereas I think Isco is a lot easier on the eye, but he doesn't produce. So if you're looking for a team that keep the ball and look pretty, then I could understand people saying they want Isco, but for me, obviously, goals win games. And I think you're more likely to get goals out of a team that has Ozil in than has Isco in. On the other side, I'm pretty sure you're just doing it to piss Tez off because they're completely different players. Yeah. But just to piss Tez off even more, yeah, Thiago in for Xhaka.
Oh, fuck off, queer cunts. but while we're just talking about Ozil for Isco, oh, mate, I would swap him every day. Isco is...
fuck yourself.
I knew I could twist that around. Okay, Schwinn, we got one for you, mate. Vish, did you want to add anything to that, mate, or do you agree with it all?
No, I agree with it. I just feel that Isco is a more direct player. If you're playing off the wings, he might just take on the player and go, whereas Ozil loves to be the maestro, where he pulls the strings and then he makes a killer pass to get Aubameyang or Lacazette in. Whereas Isco, he would take that shot and try and force a goal himself.
You go fuck but yourself too, Vish.
don't you love the way we speak to our listeners? Okay. United Arab Emiri, also known as Rocketarian. How do you rate England's chance against Belgium? Do we rate him?
The one question you should have thrown to Tony, you're going to throw it to me, Tez.
I'm going to. Actually, I thought I should have thrown this to Tony. And what is your prediction of the final group standings for Group G? We'll run around the table. Go with you first, Schwinn.
I was speaking with a friend of mine who's a United fan yesterday, and we were trying to think of midfielders, genuine midfielders that England has. And the only two that came to mind that are potentially going to start are either Dier and Henderson. And for me, that's a problem. I think the defensive talent is there, although I'm not sure what the setup will be. I think playing Kyle Walker as the right center back is madness. I also think the attacking talent is sort of there. I don't like saying this, but I think Jesse Lingard has found some good form. And the likes of Dele Alli and Harry Kane, of course, know how to play with each other. Raheem Sterling is another very good option to have along with Marcus Rashford. So I think when you look at the team up top and deep in defense, there's some good names in there. I just don't know who's going to connect at all. And I mean, no offense to Jordan Henderson. He just made a Champions League final. But can you see him ticking this team over? I cannot, to be honest. I think they seriously lack a midfielder of the traits of Adam Lallana or a Jack Wilshere. I think they're going to miss that a lot. I don't think Dele Alli can take up that role, and I think that will inevitably be their downfall. So for me, the group will probably look something like Belgium, England. I'll go Panama, and then I'll go Tunisia, although I think Tunisia will be a very good team, but I just want to go for something a bit wild and not obvious. So that'll be my group standings.
Okay. Vish, what do you reckon, Mark?
Yeah, I would say Ruben Loftus-Cheeks would fill in midfield quite nicely. But I agree with you, and definitely he's going to be Belgium on top and then followed by England and then Panama. But Tunisia, I don't see them ever winning any games over there.
Okay, and Tony, do you actually rate your England's chances against Belgium, mate?
No, I think we're shit. I think Southgate's clueless. Not clueless, that's harsh. Fuck it, it's not harsh, he's clueless. No, we're going to play. You just have to look at the players we played. We're going to play kick and run football. And for me, I think it's wasting Harry Kane, who, as much as it pains me to praise him, he's got to be in the top five strikers in the world. He has to be in anyone's list. He's got to be in the top five out and out strikers in the world. Mm. But where's the service coming from? As Schwinn said, they're not. We're going to play either Dier or Henderson and then Lingard and Ali ahead of him. Or against Belgium, I'd imagine we'll play both Henderson and Dier, and then one of them too. But none of them are the type that are going to... they're not providers. You look at even... I know people say, oh, Ali does it at Tottenham, but Eriksen is the provider at Tottenham. So I think he's just picked like the quickest players he can find, but not really... There's no football intricacy. I think Kieran Trippier, to praise another Tottenham player, is going to have probably a standout World Cup. Because his delivery is so good, and that's the only way I can see us really getting Kane into the game. You'll have Sterling running channels, and Sterling's had a great season, but he's had a great season arriving at the back post and scoring goals, but England aren't going to use him like that. So I think we're literally just going to play kick-and-run football. We're going to keep the ball pointlessly at the back when we're not really going to be pressed apart from anyone but Belgium. I really can't see how we're going to break teams down. I hope we do. I hope we win every game 5-0. I'm completely wrong and we're lifting the World Cup. I really can't see it. I mean, the Belgium games, as Schwinn said earlier, and I'm not sure if it was while we was on this call or while we was previously on, but Schwinn said that so much in 2 days, football can change 360 almost. So that Belgium game, if I had to predict it right now, I would say Belgium would beat us, but we know Belgium are prone to not being as good as everyone thinks they are. Both teams have got to play two games before that date. So it's hard to say. Like, as I said, at this moment, I would say Belgium would win. But who knows? We could be going into that game with Belgium on 0 points. I doubt it, but it's possible. In terms of the final group standing, I think these two are probably writing Tunisia off a bit harshly. Every time I've seen them, they've been very well set up, very well organised. I think they'll be boring to watch. I don't think they'll concede many goals. But I don't know anything about Panama, but Tunisia, I don't think are going to be a walkover. They lost to Spain 1-0. I know it was only a friendly, but they only lost to Spain 1-0 with a very, very late goal. And I watched the majority of that game before I got really bored. And Spain didn't really look like scoring. I think that they played three, they changed shape during it, but Tunisia played, they you can say it's three at the back, it was seven at the back, and Spain had pretty much all of the ball. Tunisia had one or two breaks, but they don't give you much space to work into, and this is why I think someone like Trippier could have a good tournament, because if they let us have the ball out wide, Trippier's delivery is very good. I'm worried about us playing Ashley Young, which it looks like from the rumoured team that Ashley Young's going to start left wing back, because he always has to come back in on his right foot to deliver. He is a better crosser of the ball than Danny Rose, but Danny Rose can do it on his left foot. And again, it just gives defences more time to organise. But I think, especially against Tunisia, a lot of our threat is going to be coming from wide areas. And again, I really think Trippier is going to have a good tournament. And I think that's the reason, why Walker's playing at centre-back, because, one, we have no pace at centre-back without him, and two, his pace against at least two of the teams, against Panama and Tunisia, who are going to defend deep, his pace will have no effect because there's not going to be any space behind to run into, and he's not the best crosser of the ball, whereas Trippier is a very good crosser of the ball. So I think the reason, I think there's two reasons there why Walker is going to play at centre-back.
Yeah, I'm looking at the group and I'm thinking, if I was England fans, I'd be wanting to play Belgium first, because I think you might do, obviously they are on paper they're a much better team, but I think they're and I'm not saying England is a bad team, but a little bit like Socceroos played France, I'm glad we played them when we did, even though we lost the game, as opposed to later in the tournament, because I think if they find momentum. Who's Belgium play first? Do they play
Panama?
So obviously that's probably going to be a bit of a walkover for Belgium, finding a bit of form, and then what, they play England last in that group, do they?
Yeah, but it's highly unlikely. I don't know the exact stats on it, but it's very rare a team loses their opening game and goes on to get through the groups, because the amount of pressure you're putting on themselves, that you essentially have to win both of the games.
Mm.
And bear in mind that you could have another team that have got a dead rubber. Do you know what I mean? So say England played Belgium first and lost.
Yep.
And then Belgium got 6 points. And by the time it comes to the last game, they're already through. And they're playing, I know, Tunisia, and they're playing their reserve team because it doesn't matter. And it can just end up really messy.
Hmm.
So it's very, very rare that a team loses their first game and goes through. I think the way it's worked out for us is probably best that you've got them last, and in a way it could be a dead rubber. If both teams have 6 points, that's it, it's done. And you could see both teams playing a weakened team and that game doesn't matter, which is another reason I wouldn't want to put a prediction on that game when it's still so far away.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think, look, Belgium and England will go through. I know nothing about Panama and Tunisia. I got nothing there either. I haven't seen any of them play, so got nothing on them ones. MAA Gunner, he asked, Tony, what's happening with what happened to Jenkinson and Brunel?
I saw this come up and I nearly tweeted answered it because I didn't realise it was in this thread. They're both still at the club. I'd imagine they both won't be by August the 11th, is it? The transfer window closes, whenever the first day of the season is, or the day before that. They're both there. Jenkinson, I think, is attracting Premier League interest. I don't know who Bramall was attracting, and the only reason he may not go is because he's not going to get the same money elsewhere, and he's got a year left on his contract, and he knows after that he's not going to earn anything like he is at the moment. So I know we often have a go at players for sitting in the reserves or in the stands and just taking their money, but for someone like him, fair play to him, because he's never going to earn that money again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot about that window closes at the start of the season this year, right?
Yeah, day before.
Yeah, so that'll be probably the 11th, 10th, I suppose. Yeah, 10th of August. Okay, that's all the questions we got this week. We didn't get many in because obviously it's World Cup and we are an Arsenal podcast doing a World Cup. So it was really good to have you, Vish, on board too, mate. Thank you.
Yeah, good to meet you guys as well.
And come back next week or whenever you want, mate, and have a chat. Always happy to talk. Anything else you boys want to add, Schwinn, Tony?
Just one thing. We didn't touch on this or mention this at all. So just a shout out to the goal Nacho scored to go 3-2 ahead in that Spain-Portugal game. That might be the best goal of the tournament so far for sure, but maybe even maybe even by the end of it. So that was a howler.
Okay. Actually, just before we go, I believe it's Father's Day everywhere around the world except for Australia. Is that right, Schwinn?
Well, it is here in America. I know the Brits tend to celebrate it in March, I think, if I'm not wrong.
No, it is here. It's Father's Day here.
Okay. It is? Oh, is there another Mother's Day then, perhaps, in Britain?
Yeah, I think Mother... I don't know when it is, but I think March sounds about right.
Yeah, because Mother's Day, I think, in the rest of the world is in May. So, yeah, it is Father's Day, and good on you, Tez, to bring that up. And happy Father's Day to you as well, Tez.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Yeah, I don't even know. We celebrate it later in the year, so... But everybody out there and all the fathers, have a great day because we are recording on Father's Day, and enjoy your time with your kids. Okay, boys, we'll be back next week, and at what stage, we don't know when. We'll squeeze a podcast in between a couple of World Cup games. So thank you for listening, and thank you for downloading, and thank you, everybody, for interacting with us on Twitter. You can follow us at @clockend_talk. Thanks again, boys. Till next week.